Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
Welcome, and thanks for listening. This is a combination of Dominican and Carmelite spirituality here, where I'm a Dominican, and I follow St. Thomas Aquinas, especially on the nature of the soul, and he does follow Aristotle, so philosophers should also be happy about that. And then I am going to follow Teresa of Avila's idea of contemplation, because that was asked of me to do, and I thought that was a wonderful request. So this is unique for Texas A&M. First of all, we'll talk about the nature of the soul, which is unique to all of creation. The human soul and the human person, really, with body and soul, is a bridge between all corporeal reality, as St. Thomas says, and the spiritual reality, like angels who have no bodies, and God, of course, who is pure spirit. So the spiritual and the material are combined in the human person, and that's what makes us so unique and sometimes so frustrating. That doesn't always work so well, or it seems like they can be at odds with each other. But actually, this is a wonderful creation, and God thought it was so fantastic that he took on human nature. So it has to be something pretty special. So this bridge between the sentient life, like animalistic, animal-like, up above us we have all different kinds of angels. These are different natures, actually, but all in common, the angelic nature, which is pure spirit. But they have different jobs and they do different things. That's a different talk. Right? And below us, we have animal life, sentient life, going all the way down to like a one-celled amoeba, right? Or even minerals and electrons. Right? I don't know what a Higgs boson is, but probably you all do. Where's that physics person? Right? I don't know what that is. So the human person is in the middle. And these are just nice pictures to remind us of what an amazing thing it is that God would create this kind of creature that would have a body and an immaterial soul. Okay. Made to the image of God, the receiver of truth, goodness, and beauty, that we have, even with our sentient life, this ability to know, to love, and to bask in or delight in beauty. And that's proper to us as human beings. Now, the powers of the soul, this you might get straight from Aristotle, but I think Thomas perfects it and adds to it the will, which Aristotle doesn't have a clear sense of what the will is, so we need to talk about the will. But the vegetative and sensitive powers, well, those are just pretty much observationary, right? That the lower powers of the soul we have in common with plants. And that's the best way to say it. We have in common with plants vegetative powers. So the ability to take in nutrients and grow, that comes from the plants can do that too. So that indicates a living soul that has those kind of powers. The sensitive powers, a little more complicated. These include the emotions. And our emotions are a little bit more related to our psyche as well. So they can psychological as well as bodily. But animals have lots of emotions, as you know. They love you. The tag, the whale, the dog wags his tail, right, as a sign of he's happy. So we have those kind of things too. And the intellective powers, the intellect and the will. And that's why they're called intellective, that the intellect and will are always together. Two different operating powers, however, they always act together, which is going to be an important point. So in detail, just really quickly, the vegetative powers are growth, nutrition, reproduction, and photosynthesis. I put in there, people debate me on that, and you might know better than I do, scientists maybe, if we really do photosynthesis. But if we get vitamin D from the sun, that's good enough for me. Like, I think that's photosynthesis, but maybe it's not exactly. Okay, it's close, okay. But it's a kind of a vegetative power. Now, you might be surprised, reproduction is, it could be so low. It seems low in the totem pole. That's a vegetative power. Well, remember, it's a human soul, which is one with all these powers in common with other animals and plants. And so reproduction is not considered a low thing in an intellective life like we have. So it's united to our intellect and will, these powers. Okay, so we don't denigrate them just because we have them in common with plants. Okay. Sensitive powers, I told you, more complicated, so this is a long list. Ready? Locomotion, self-movement. Even the amoeba can move itself a little bit with hairs or something. The five external senses, and you probably know what these are because we make you memorize them in grade school, right? So sight, hearing, those kind of ones. Okay, so the five external senses, sight, hearing, smell, taste, and touch. And touch is pretty pervasive. Thomas says that's the most pervasive of all of these external powers, external sense powers. Then we have internal sense powers. Once you taste something or smell something or touch it, then there's an internal sense that brings it all together. That's called the common sense, so that we understand what the thing is I'm touching. Okay. And then memory and imagination are going to be in there too. The interior senses, memory, imagination, common sense. And last but not least, estimative sense. This often gets left off in a list, but Thomas hits it because this is that hard thing to describe, like women's intuition kind of thing, right? That you sense danger or you sense delight. It's usually good or evil, right? So I perceive something, but I can't put my finger on it. But I have a sense for there's a danger here. It's in animals, it's much more specialized and active because the rabbit doesn't have to be told that the wolf is dangerous to it, right? But we sometimes have to be told the wolf is dangerous to us, or, you know, something's dangerous. But if you have a sense for that, it could be that your estimative sense is pretty attuned. And that's, even though it's a sensitive animalistic power that animals have, we do have it too. And so you should pay attention to that. It might be something that's going to save your life. Like, just all of a sudden, it could also be your guardian angel. So I don't want to say everything's natural. Right? But on the natural level, we have this ability. And sometimes it's called intuition. Okay. And then we also have the 11 passions. These are sometimes called the emotions, and we can use the term interchangeably for now. Passio meaning to be moved, able to suffer. Passio comes from that word, to suffer. So it means to respond. It's an impulse. It provides an impulse to act or to move based on what I perceive as good or evil. So all of our emotional life, and they can be pretty complicated, are all based on love for what is good, and aversion to what I perceive as evil, to what I perceive as good and what I perceive as evil. So that's another talk on the passions, if you want that someday, right? I'm just going to mention them here just because they're so fascinating and they are integrated, again, with our intellect and will. So they respond to what I'm thinking. Oh, that's fun, right? Okay. You don't want to manipulate yourself too much, but it works, right? So for the most part, you are responding even emotionally to what you receive all the time, no matter how you receive it. Okay. So it's just good to know that, and it's all based on love for what is good. They can be divided into concupiscible and irascible appetites. I'm just going to list them here quickly because they're based on what is good and evil. When I see something good, I love it. I just have an emotion of love, emotional reaction. I haven't moved yet. Like the cupcake is my example of good. And a simple evil. So concupiscible means responding to a simple good or evil. To me, that's olives. Right? So I just don't like them. So I don't. There's no real reason. I just don't like the taste. Right? So that to me is, you have a hatred, emotional hatred, which is not moral, to evil. Right? What I perceive as evil. If the thing is not present to me, it's thinking about it, I'll also have an emotion of desire for this thing. Love and desire go together for this cupcake. And then I'll have, if the thing is not present to me, I'll have an aversion. It can be slight or it can be strong to whatever I perceive as evil. When I attain the good, when I have the cupcake, I experience joy, emotional joy. There's also going to be joy on the level of the will. So a lot of these things will span emotions and will. And that's where we get nice and complicated, right? In morals. If I the evil is present to me and I have to eat it, I experience a little bit of an emotional sadness, right? And that's where sadness comes from. It's that something I perceive as evil is present and I have to deal with it. I might have to swallow it or suffer it, right? So sadness is the suffering. The irascible appetites are after responses to something I perceive as good or evil, but difficult. So there's difficulty involved in this good, like it's difficult to get the good, or it's difficult to avoid the evil. And these are more intense emotions usually, right? Where they get the name ira is from anger, the Latin for anger. And it's going to end in anger because that's the most difficult passion, actually, to sustain. So if I perceive a good that's difficult to attain, but I think I can overcome the difficulty to get it, I'm going to have the emotion of hope. And if I think that I see an evil that's difficult to avoid, then I have the emotion of, I think I can overcome the difficulty involved in avoiding this evil. I have the emotion of courage. So hope and courage go together as far as I think I can overcome it. So the next line is going to be, what if I think I can't overcome it? Then I'll have another set of emotions, okay? A difficult good, I think I can't get it. That's going to be despair. And if it's a difficult evil, I think I can't overcome it, I have fear. So fear, it's interesting to notice, is regarding an evil. So I think if it's regarding, it's a response, a natural response on the emotional level, which is not willed, to something that I'm perceiving, an evil that I can't avoid. Final exam, right? Okay, yeah, something like that. But if I think I can overcome it, I'm going to do well on my final exams. I have the emotion of courage, okay? And hope and despair, again, are about something good. Despair is about something that I see as good, but I don't think I can get it. What's the highest good you can ever have? God. Heaven. What if I think I can't get heaven? Despair. Emotional will set in. And if I think I can get to heaven, I have hope, right? The emotion of hope. Now, these two are actually, if they're willed, all four of these can be willed. So that means they can become virtues or vices. That's so fun, right? This is a side point, but it's too hard to resist, right, saying it. So hope can be a virtue because I think I can get to heaven. That's the highest good there is, and I want that. And who do I rely on to get to heaven? God, yeah, not me, right? Don't rely on Sister Mary Angelica. I mean, I'm powerful, but I'm not that powerful. I can't do it, right? But God can do it. When I really realize, have faith, and I understand that God can get me to heaven, terrible as I am, think of St. Augustine, if you're ever feeling bad, right, about yourself, read St. Augustine. God can do it with him. He can do it with me. Right. So I hope in God to get to heaven. So if I don't hope in God, if I think, oh, he loves everyone else, but he doesn't love me, that's going to be despair. And if I actually say I accept that in my will, that would actually be a sin of despair. So these can be, if they're chosen, that this can affect us. And our emotions are, you know, they're always around, right? So, and they do drive us. You respond to everything. Fear is a little more complicated because that can be good. You can have filial fear, fear of God and sense of awe. Not, I'm afraid that he's evil. God's not evil. But I'm afraid of losing him. That's the kind of good fear. That's fear of the Lord. I'm afraid of losing God. But I could do that, right? On my own, that would be my fault. Okay, the last one, I'm sure you're dying to know, right? Why are there only 11? There should be 12. Oh. Well, if you attain the difficult good, you get reverted back to joy, but it's a deeper joy because it was more difficult to get. And then if the sad evil thing is here and I can't get rid of it, and it's a very difficult thing, very difficult evil or an intense evil, I'll experience anger. So anger and sadness. Anger is like, a more pronounced form of sadness. And if we have a lot of sadness, it can turn into anger and vice versa. They can interplay with each other. So there's the emotions in 5 minutes. Okay, right. That could be a whole semester long course. But just so you know, it's all based on love. Love for what is good. And when I don't have that, I have what's evil. Or I'm missing the good, that's evil to me. It's all based on love. That to me was life changing, that understanding. Oh, nothing. Okay. So Let's just say the intellective powers. We're going to move to the intellective powers, okay? So the spiritual faculties by which we know something, that's the intellect, and the will is the spiritual faculty for desire and delight in something that I perceive as good. So it depends on the intellect to perceive something that's good. I have to perceive the cupcake. And I do have to know something about the cupcake, that it's got a lot of frosting. The more frosting, the better it is, the more I desire it, right? So they work together to attain whatever is truly good for me here and now. And then, you know, ultimately heaven. So think of God as the ultimate good. The intellect and the will are our spiritual powers for acting toward deciding that I want that and I'm going to go for it. Okay. And they are a little bit complicated. Right? So on your handout, you see my little arrows pointing to the intellect's object is the truth and the will's object is the good. So the intellect's operation is geared toward getting the truth in my intellect. This is what it's made for. And should we go through all the operations? I don't want to spend too much more time, but it is the nature of the soul. That's what. Okay, let's see. Yeah, okay, have them there listed on your handout. So in order to get truth in my intellect, it's not that easy. Now, there is a side point you could write on the side, like outside the list there. God can infuse it in there anytime. So you can ask him to do that, and that's really nice. I love when he does that. But it's not how the intellect works naturally on our own, right? We can't have any control over that. But just so you know, God can do that. And if you want a good example, you want to read St. Augustine's Confessions, where he did it to Augustine. It's kind of when he was late in life, at age 30. But it was well done, right? So on its own, the intellect works by abstraction, judgment, and reasoning. So by when you see a white blob coming towards you, you're wondering, is that a walking marshmallow? Or is it Sister Mary Angelica? I don't know. Is it a Dominican? Or is it a marshmallow? And your intellect wants to know the truth of the matter. Once it sees that something exists, it wants to know the essence of the thing. You can't help that. That's the nature of the intellect, which is wonderful. Because once you know that God exists, you want to know the essence of God. You want to know the nature of it. What is God? St. Thomas asked that when he was 4 years old. What is God? Oh, that's a good question. And spent the rest of his life finding out. Because the essence of God is above our intellect. But we know it exists, so we want to know. And what's so bad about it. There was this saying, I think, in the 90s or the 80s, maybe, why ask why? You know, everything's useless. There is no essence to know. You know, this kind of despair. That's really super bad for the intellect. Or, to say something even worse, there is no truth. Don't record this. How to set Sister Mary Angelica off, right? if you haven't seen me do this before, I'll just do it really quickly. So if someone says to you, there is no truth, you ask them, do you think that's true? And you got the joke, right? So if you chuckled, you got the joke. I'm getting less and less chuckles because it's more and more disturbing how many people are accustomed to and accepting of that statement, there is no truth. And they really think it's true. That's what's so weird about it, right? Self-contradiction, when you start that way with the intellect, what are your chances of getting truth in your intellect? And how are you going to know anything? I don't even mean physics, right? But God. Yeah. This is so, it's so against our nature, right? That now what the truth is, okay, we can argue all day long. That's fun for me, right? What it is. But that there has to be a truth that my intellect wants, an essence of something, even if it's rocks, we can talk, right? And observation is not a bad way of finding things out, just so you know. Right? That's why we love science. Okay, so abstraction, you abstract concepts from what you perceive, and you make these abstract concepts, like chairness, human beingness, right? The human nature, that things have natures. And then you have these concepts, you put them together to try to get a judgment because you're after what is true. That is a chair. Got it. Right? That's a judgment. So judgments are good, right? Because you need them. You can't reason without them. And then you make judgments, and then you line them up in a syllogism. If A equals B and B equals C, then Aggieland. That's what I love about Aggies. They can do it. A equals C, right? Even the lowest math class, right? You got that, right? Now, of course, B has to really be B. You can't lie about that, right? You got to have things that line that are actually true for this to be true. And if my judgments are bad, if A is not really B, and those Bs are not really the same, then it's not going to work. Okay, right. But if they are, you can come up with a true statement from a true judgment. And this is how we, that's why you're in school. This is how we get any truth in our intellect. So reasoning, yeah, you should take logic, right? Because it's good for the soul, right? And it helps us to get the object of the intellect into the intellect. And as truth is really the conformation of the intellect with reality. So non-reality in my intellect, how harmful is that going to be? Very. Thank you. Extremely. Very bad. So we do spend most of our life trying to get out things that I had that were wrong. Even about God, you know, because God is a mystery. Right? So yeah, theology is like inexhaustible. We're going to be doing this forever. And it's fun when you get truth in there. When you get false in there, guess what? The intellect is unhappy. It's not resting. It doesn't love it. The will doesn't love it if it's not true. So what happens is sometimes we have to change our mind when we find out the truth. Right? So that's a good process. That's why we're in school. And then for the will, oh, this the job of the will, the nature of the will is to desire in whatever's perceived as good, to desire the good, universal, anything that's good. And cupcakes are always good, right? But not during Lent. So the cupcake is the good for me, right? So as soon as I talk about a cupcake, I have a desire for it. Maybe it's just sensitive, but on the level of the will, my intellect perceives this as a really good, good. Mm-hmm. That's something to work for. Oh, I didn't, sorry, come back. the will depends on the intellect for perceiving the goodness of the thing. There's something good about it. So the robber thinks that robbing the bank is good. So be careful, right? The intellect has a job to do here. Is it truly good or is it false good? And the cupcake, well, it's good of itself. It's always good. But is it good here and now during Lent? No, usually, right? So we have to decide on that. The will be engaged. And then the will is the faculty that delights in the good once obtained. This is really important. And we have to help children, especially if we see a child that doesn't delight in a good, we're really worried about that child. Like something happened that's really damaging because they should delight in a good, even if it's just a cupcake, right? Okay. Well, he's stuck. Okay, that's all right. I'm used to this. No worries. Right? You have your handout, so we're good on the handout. Okay, so the nature of the will is to desire and to delight. Notice I did not say the nature of the will is to choose. This is wrong, right? And it's a wrong reading of St. Thomas Aquinas, because if that were the case, that would mean that the will is fulfilled by choosing itself, just choosing. And doesn't matter if it's truly good or not. And this is the problem we have in modern mentality, right? If you want more on that, then you can read my book, right? Where I go to town on that, right? That this wrong understanding of freedom is really the wrong understanding of the will. That the will is fulfilled by being able to choose. Well, no, actually, a choice is a combination of the intellect and will together, choosing the cupcakes. Good job. Yeah. Okay. Together, the intellect and the will have to perceive the true good and decide on a course of action for obtaining it. This is what we do in all of our life. Right? So I'm going to go get the cupcake. And I have to take steps to do that. Get in the car, drive over. Oh, I forgot money. Go back and get money. Come back to the store and then buy the cupcake, right? So choosing is a much more complicated thing. It's not the will alone. This is a misreading of Aquinas, just so that we can fix that right now. So it's a combined operation of intellect and will to move toward something I perceive as truly good. If I'm wrong about that, I won't be able to truly delight. It will only be like maybe a sensitive delight. So the robber who robs the bank
he delights in that for a few minutes, but it's only on the sense level. It's only on an animalistic level, maybe, that he can delight in that, only emotionally. And he might think that's intense. Emotions can be intense. But will that really satisfy his soul? We're going to say no. Eventually, he'll find out this was a bad thing to do. You know, at least before he does. He'll find that out, right? Same with us on everything, right? Hopefully you're not robbing banks, right? Mm-hmm. But this works, that the will and the intellect only can be resolved by choosing a true good. False goods won't work. So the passions are supposed to help. That's why it's a broken line. They don't always help. Sometimes they can lead us off, be wanting a false good and leading that way. And sometimes we have to resist them. But eventually with virtue, with choosing a true good in spite of my passions, I train them to eventually actually desire the true good as well. And they do that. I can promise you that will happen. Right? If you do this practice, it will happen. It might take years, but it's worth it, right? To build up those virtues of especially temperance and fortitude in the face of unruly passions. Not to squash them, and you don't beat them. Like Aristotle says, do not beat the horse. It's like a horse. You don't beat the horse into subjection. You guide it gently. Same with the emotions. They're like horses. Right? So you guide them gently, and eventually they make it to resting in what the intellect and will perceive as truly good. It's why it's so important to know what they do. Okay. So man's highest act, we often think, is to do something, to produce something, to choose. But no, choosing is a means to an end. It's to rest in the beatific vision, the ultimate truth, the ultimate good, which is God himself, and anything that leads to God. Can the cupcake lead to God? Good question during Lent. Well, if all the conditions are right, it's, you know, you're not diabetic and... it's not really going to be hurtful to you and you enjoy it. Yes, it can lead to God if you order it that way with my intellect and will. Lord, thank you for the cupcake. I delight in you. Yum. And the cupcake too. Can you have that? God and a cupcake? Yes. Right. If he wills, right? Same with marriage, right? So marriage really, is more than a cupcake. Right? So marriage is a big deal. Right? So this is... a really high good. This is the highest good of friendship is marriage. But is that other person going to completely satisfy my intellect and will? Are they the ultimate true and good? No. So why would you marry anyone? No, just kidding. Why would you do that? Because together, we want to get to the highest good together. That's what marriage is about. That's why I think they don't last. If they don't last, it's a lot of times because we have the wrong understanding of what this is all about, that I want to bind myself to this person who thinks the same way I do about God, that would really be helpful, right? To get to God together. So it doesn't have to match absolutely perfectly. Nobody's perfectly the same, right? I did meet one person I thought was exactly like me, but I'm still not sure about that. and probably not, right? Because we're all unique. But if you get married, it's not because they're my ultimate fulfillment, right? God is my ultimate fulfillment. That's the nature of our intellect and will. So hence, this is going to be the lead into, guess what? Contemplation, right? That if God is my ultimate fulfillment, well, eternal life is this, to know you, the one true God, and Jesus Christ, whom you have sent. This is how it leads into what's going to fulfill the intellect. Aristotle thought it was the contemplation of truth, because he knew truth was the highest thing for the soul. He didn't have such an understanding of the will, and that's why that's kind of left out with Aristotle. But he's so close. So close to understanding that is actually what you're going to do in heaven. Contemplate the truth. Could you ever be bored with that? Probably not, right? Start now and you'll start seeing, right? No, it's inexhaustible. Reading scriptures is a wonderful way to kind of help you do that. It's another, one of my other favorite sayings, I think it's going to come up, is about truth. So here I have one. Finally, brothers and sisters, whatever is true, whatever is noble, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, those are all attractive things. We see those as good. Whatever is admirable, if anything is excellent or praiseworthy, think about these things. Contemplate these things, because this will bring you to God somehow. even if you contemplate the beauty of a cupcake. That would bring you to God. It could, especially if you order it to him and say, God, thank you for the cupcake.
Then you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. This is my favorite line in scripture. I think it might be my favorite.
The only the truth will set you free. Falsity will never set you free. And that's why we study. This is why I teach all day long. And I get to teach about God. I'm the luckiest person in the world. Oh, I shouldn't brag.
So contemplation is the contemplation of truth, is the just thinking about, the mulling over in the mind, using my intellect and will. Because can you choose to think about something and choose to not think about something?
Yeah, hopefully you're getting good at that, right, in school, because you can't think about everything all the time. So you have to choose. No, I'm not going to think about that till tomorrow. Right? You have to do that. So your will's involved, and I will to think. This is contemplation. I will to study, meditate, bask in, and enjoy. That's like a higher contemplation, to just enjoy and rest in the mystery of whatever is true. And of course, the highest truth is going to be the incarnation, Jesus, right? And the Trinity. Try that one. That will keep you busy for a long time. The Trinity. Explaining that one. So, there's a natural kind of contemplation, which is the intuition of truth, goodness, and beauty, resting in the enjoyment of it. Musicians and artists kind of know this one. They sort of bank on it, and they used to call it the muse that would have to come to inspire them to bask in the beauty and create things, be creative as a production, but also just enjoy. Think about it and enjoy it. And then supernaturally, it's a loving, intuitive experience of God, a gift of grace. So according to St. Thomas Aquinas, true contemplation is supernatural, and it's a gift of God. So can you say, I'm going to go contemplate tomorrow? I wish. Right? Not in this sense that it's a supernatural gift, but can you dispose yourself to receive this gift? Oh, yes. Yes. By willing it. Yes. And that usually means praying. Right? So if you went to church tonight, that would be a beautiful church. It's really conducive to contemplation because the beauty is all around you. And it's so beautiful in there. It just feels good. Wow. Those arches, they make you feel good. I don't know that about architecture, but that's what it does. It's supposed to make you feel good. And enjoy a possible, if God wants to give it, experience of God. So the rest of this, I want to talk about contemplation itself. There we are, contemplating Jesus as the incarnation. That'll keep you busy. How does God become man? I never can start or think about that one. Okay, some of my favorite quotes. We're going to skip those. God is love, and he who abides in love abides in God, and God in him. And ultimately, that's what heaven is, to abide in love. And it starts on earth. You can have it on earth by wanting, by desiring it, will. These are the stages of prayer from St. Teresa of Avila. I was going to go through each one of them, but I'm going to skip down to contemplation. Okay, so the first four are ascetical. They involve me doing work, meditating, vocal prayer, effective prayer, which means a prayer simplicity of the heart, like prayer of simplicity that I rest in the desire for God, or maybe I have a dry desire for God. That's going to happen. If you start praying, you have a dry period, which means it's just a matter of will. My will wants God, and I feel like nothing's happening. This is actually good news, right? Because you're being purified. So don't be afraid of that. Persevere and ask God for the gift. Not just I want always my prayer to be consolation. I wish. Right? That doesn't happen, right? After 35 years, it's not always consolation, right? I can tell you that. But is it always wonderful? It's always wonderful. I never regret one second that I ever gave to God in prayer. And even if it was dry and just painfully filled with distractions, he still loves me. And he loves the fact that I was there. And he accepts that. That's a sacrifice we give him. And this is part of our purification. So that's going to be part of it. This is the ascetical part, that it's kind of work, a little bit of work, right? And time. You have to set it aside and plan on it and work on it. Then there comes the mystical stage. Now, it's not always so clear cut as Teresa of Avila is talking about here, right? So it's not just that
If you put in the work, then eventually you're going to hit contemplation and God will start giving you gifts. However, we notice it's kind of uncanny that it does happen, right? Now, we can't force God. God wants to give, though, and he does want us to feel his love and to know his love. And when that starts happening, we call that contemplative prayer. It usually looks like this, that the soul has trouble meditating. And St. Teresa of Avila said, I can't meditate anymore. And so for many years, she just couldn't meditate. That was a lower ascetical prayer, and God kept giving her infused prayer. So another term for contemplative prayer is mystical prayer or infused prayer. It means that God is giving some touches to the intellect or the will or both, and you might understand something or you might not. You might get an understanding, you might not. But it's supernatural, so we can't just say, I'm going to do this, right? But you can dispose yourself, and God seems to want us to do it. So I hope that it happens, right? And so Teresa of Avila kind of pulls it all apart in these stages here. When the mystical prayer starts happening, this is how she describes it. You have an experience of the presence of God, and you can't describe it. Sorry. Right. Look to St. Augustine if you want to try to describe it. He tries to describe it, and he does a really great job. It's kind of an invasion of the soul by the supernatural, by God. It's impossible to produce by one's own efforts. You can't just make yourself feel this, right? It's more than a feeling. It's not just a feeling. It's in the intellect and will, so it's not in the passions. You might not feel it in your passions, but you just know it in your intellect and will. The soul is more passive than active. You're not doing something. You're receiving something. We call it an experimental knowledge of God. It's not clear. It's obscure and confused, and that's why people usually come away confused. And they go to the priest and say, what just happened? I don't know. Went by like 10 minutes, but it was an hour. Oh, that might be mystical prayer. Maybe. You can't describe it. And there wasn't something really emotional, but there was something that happened. It was an experience of God. Okay. You might be able to put words to it, and maybe you did get concepts. That's nice. I like when that happens because I'm so conceptually oriented. But it doesn't have to do that. You do have an assurance that somehow you're under the action of God. It was nice. Right? There was something nice about it. There's more. You have more certitude of this happening if you're in the state of grace. Now, Augustine had this happen when he was not in the state of grace, but God got him there pretty quickly, right? But it was the beginning of his conversion where he had this experience of God. It's indescribable. Delight can overflow to the senses, and that's always lovely. There's a kind of a suspension of the faculties. Like, they're not working, but something's happening, and I'm not doing it. Oh, right? God's overtaking my soul, right? But it's not violent. It's very nice. It's pleasant. It leaves the soul with these marks or effects that are kind of crucial, with a great impulse for virtue. That's a nice test, right? Well, how are you feeling about virtue? That's what the priest is going to ask you. And the soul makes great strides in virtue. And gets it's not purified from all defects, but is making strides. And that's how it shows that you want virtue and actually work on it, and God's giving the grace to succeed. This is a nice effect of contemplative prayer, and that's why God wants to give it, right? So the soul in this state should strive to completely surrender to God in all its daily life. Talk to him about everything. Lord, do you want me to eat the cupcake? What do you mean, no? Okay, I'll do what you want. You want me to go to class? Okay, I'll go. And he helps me to do it. And then everything becomes a matter of conversation with God. This is growing in virtue. It's helping the communion of the soul with God. And that's going to, when you go to prayer again, it's going to more likely that it will happen again, that God wants to do something in my soul. It usually has these really good effects, like virtue. Okay. But it happens like in spurts in the beginning. Little douses of it. It's time. Okay, yeah, we have to stop. And then he's going to bring it to the transforming union at the end, right? The three unions, the Teresa of Avila prayer of quiet is a kind of also just an awareness of God in the soul, is more aware of it. It's the same kind of thing, mystical activities happening that you can't control. And God captivates not only the intellect, but also the will. And then the three unions are different stages of how God captivates intellect, will, external senses, and internal senses.
so that the whole soul, I love how she does it. I mean, she explains it beautifully in Interior Castle about how God will captivate the whole essence of the soul, everything, all of our faculties, but little by little, and starts at the core with the intellect and will, and then goes out to all the external senses will be last. So, and then that's called the mystical marriage, something we're all called to. So, yes, everyone, right? Even men, yes, right? Even men are called to this intimate union with God that we, the best analogy we have is marriage, mystical marriage. So you have all these women who love to talk about this, right? Catherine of Siena and Teresa of Avila, it's the mystical marriage. We receive a ring from him and he's my husband and this is so happy. I mean, I couldn't be happier. But I know men are like, wait a minute. Right? Oh, I'm not so sure. But it is true. However you want to think about it, sometimes they think of themselves as the friend of the bridegroom, but it's more intimate than even our image of marriage. God's union with the soul, because nobody else can unite themselves with your intellect and will. Nobody else can do that. No matter how much you think alike or wish alike or will alike, they're really not going to be united to your intellect and will the way God will. And it's like a bridegroom, and he calls himself the bridegroom. So we are the bride.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.